Welcome to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 71, otherwise known as season 4, episode 14. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How are you doing, Jacob?
Much better.
Much better? Were you not doing well?
Well, I was moving, and as you can imagine, the experience was extremely unpleasant and was awful.
And right after you moved, you skipped town.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, too. I'm better because I finished moving and then immediately went on vacation on the East Coast. I'm currently recording this from a friend's place. Just doing this off of an air mattress. So a bit of a change of pace, but, you know, I'll make it work.
All right. So if you hear him bouncing, it's because he is. Also with us today is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, Correa?
Doing great. I'm back in LA after being on the road for a month, which is tiring. Very tiring.
Yeah, you know, we need to apologize because we missed a week, and basically because the world is kind of opening back up, which means our lives are opening back up.
It's the summer, man. Summer, you know, shows pick back up. And then, yeah, cinemas are back open, so Jacob's busy and just... You know, we tried. We had a pretty cool guest lined up, and it just scheduling. I'll take most of the blame on that because I was road warrioring it up and being an a-hole, just driving all over. You know, to sweet spots like Spotsylvania, Virginia.
So, what has been going on? What have you guys been seeing? Anything good?
Well, I just came back from seeing James Gunn's The Suicide Squad. And tell you, it was exactly my kind of jam. It's the kind of James Gunn movie you love because it is a James Gunn movie. And, you know, like one of my favorite reviews described it best as a $180 million trauma movie. Just if you're the kind of person who enjoys James Gunn movies, this is the James Gunn movie to enjoy. Because, yeah, it's just great to see him get back to his roots, like, you know, able to do something that is extremely gory and splatsticky and gross and weird and where anybody can die. So the stakes are really high. And it's just, if you like his stuff, you'll like this.
Well, and that's the thing is that a lot of the reviews, especially the poll quotes from reviews, I feel, are focusing a lot on the violence, the splat, the inappropriate humor, all that. And it's definitely all there. There's no denying it that Suicide Squad has a lot of that, and it's fantastic. But it's also just like a genuinely pretty well, nice, tight, you know, action ride. Like it wears its influences on its sleeves. I almost immediately wanted to watch the original Inglourious Basterds and Wild Geese after viewing it yesterday. The action's fantastic. I love that even though the ultimate threat in the movie is kind of an intergalactic threat, because that's where all superhero movies go, right? It's never, oh shit, I gotta stop this guy because he's a bad guy. It's always, I gotta save the galaxy, I gotta save the world. And even though this film does get to that point, it still feels like a small contained personal story. I always connect more with the superhero stories where it's like, this guy's trying to take over this block, this guy's trying to take over the city, or just like, hey, this guy's being a righteous dick. And I feel like even though that they do go for that bigger type of villain, I mean, Starro is huge. That's the original villain that brought the Justice League together in the comics. But he's also a product of his time. He's a very much so a golden age comics villain. And he does look ridiculous. So I'm glad that they like found a really good balance with that. And I think that's the thing that I admire most about this Suicide Squad is there is really good balance. Yes, there's a lot of dick jokes, but there's also a lot of heart. They do a really good job of not taking back steps with Harley Quinn's character and having her, you see the growth, whether it's her having tattoos modified or removed, or just like how she interacts with people. One of the big plot points is directly tied to the growth that she had in Birds of Prey. And I thought that was really good seeing these there's so many characters in this movie. It's a big ensemble, but they're all really fleshed out. They all have their faults. They all have, you know, their weaknesses. And I thought that was really good that they took the time to do that, because that's really important, because you got to know and you got to love these characters. But it, like you said, anyone can die. It's a suicide mission that they're on. That's why they're called the Suicide Squad. And they do. And so there's like actual like weight behind it. It's not just, I don't know, the first film, it felt like it was trying too hard to come up with stuff to sell on Hot Topic t-shirts. And this one, you could definitely tell that they were trying to make a movie.
If I had known that we were going to be talking about the Suicide Squad so much, I would have seen it.
Why didn't you?
Well, I'm going to go into that right now. It's playing on HBO Max, so I couldn't. I just haven't gotten a chance since it's been playing on HBO Max because of, I don't know, same reasons we missed our last recording. I've gotten 5 hours sleep in the last 48 hours. But the press screening, which was on Tuesday before it opened, I actually RSVP'd for it. I was going to go, but then I found out it was press slash promo and they were packing the theater to 90%. And
ew.
San Diego is a Delta variant hotspot. And yeah, I'm fully vaxxed, but the Delta doesn't care. So, yeah. You know, vax just means you're not going to go to the hospital, but I'm not bringing that home, you know, to my wife or, you know, I'm not spreading that around. So I backed out of that. But the Monday before it, I saw Free Guy, which was press only. So there are like 15 people. It's not really horror. Most of the stuff I've seen isn't really horror. So I'm going to not spend a whole lot of time on it. But Free Guy is the one with Ryan Reynolds as a non-player character in a video game that suddenly becomes sentient of himself.
NPC, they call him.
Yeah, yeah. Non-player character.
Non-playable character.
Yeah, that's what NPC stands for. He's a bank teller whose bank always gets robbed because that's one of the missions in the game. Is bank heist. So every day he goes to work and his bank gets robbed. But one day he figures out some stuff and he becomes Blue Shirt Guy, which is, it becomes this viral sensation in this game because it's one of those massive multiplayer universe games online. And everybody's like, who's playing Blue Shirt Guy? He's not a player. It's kind of fun. But anyway, I don't want to go too far into it because first of all, it's better to just experience it. But also it's not horror. But probably the most horror thing I've seen, and I'm hoping you guys have both seen this, The Green Knight. You guys see it?
I actually got a story about that because I'm back in my hometown and I was looking for something to do. And my local theater, the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts, was actually doing a screening of The Green Knight. And after that, they were doing a 35 millimeter revival screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So I watched both back to back.
It's actually a pretty appropriate double feature.
It really is. Mean,
it's that Arthurian lore.
I'm so jealous of you.
Have you not seen The Green Knight, Korea?
No. Oh,
so good. And see it in a theater. Try to find yourself dead screening because it is a big screen movie. It is a beautifully made movie.
Dude, I just got home yesterday. And the first thing I did was drink an energy drink and watch Suicide Squad and then pass out.
Now, the Green Knight, it's a beautifully made movie. It looks gorgeous. The score is incredible. Dev Patel is awesome in it. And then the rest of the cast, Alicia Vikander, she pulls double duty. She plays two different roles. I don't want to spoil what they are, but and then Sean Harris is the king. They never call him King Arthur, but if you know the lore, he's fucking King Arthur. And then it's Ralph Ineson from The Witch is the quote Green Knight. He's fully CG'd because the Green Knight in this is almost like a tree. He's not really even a man. But anyway, it's terrific. It is so good. There's one scene in it. And this is probably the closest to horror it gets that involves like a ghost. And it's kind of a side quest scene, but I can't stop thinking about it. It's chilling. Anyway, see The Green Knight. It's beautiful.
Seconded. I love The Green Knight. It was very haunting. So, I mean, it's not outright horror, but a lot of it is very eerie, especially if you think about it in certain ways. But yeah, Dev Patel was great. I'm a sucker for that type of fantasy. So yeah, check out The Green Knight if you can. And again, it does make a surprisingly good double feature with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which is the other thing. Like I can understand The Green Knight taking creative liberties with Arthurian lore, but we all know Gawain was killed with Hector and Boris by the killer rabbit.
Well, you're spoiling it because if you know the Green Knight legend, you know how the Green Knight turns out, which is weird because it almost looks like it's going to throw you a curve in The Green Knight, and it almost lost me at the end, and then it brought it back, and I'm like, okay, I'm on board again. But yeah, The Green Knight's incredible. I wish that you could have seen Excalibur before it too for the triple feature, because I feel like Excalibur would have just put you over the top. The Green Knight's actually, it's a good companion film to Excalibur, actually.
Oh, definitely. It had that Borman vibe.
Yes, absolutely. It's David Lowry who did A Ghost Story and the remake of Pete's Dragon. So it's a pretty dark movie. In fact, one of my critic friends actually said, if you're going to see The Green Knight, this is in his review, if you're going to see The Green Knight, bring a seeing eye dog because you're not going to see anything on screen. I'm like, that's not quite true, but it's a pretty dark movie.
Very true. Both in content and image.
Has anyone seen someone do a trailer mashup yet of the for the Green Knight, where it's the Green Knight trailer, but with the Green Power Ranger?
That no. would be very fun.
I'm just saying, like this whole time, like as soon as James said, like, oh yeah, if you know the Green Knight lore, if you know the Green Knight story, all I could think of is, well, yeah, he was the White Ranger and he was evil. He took them all out with his knife flute thing. Wait, no, he was the Green Ranger and then he became the White Ranger. And I'm like, wait, no, that's Power Rangers.
Now, another thing that's not really horror, but it goes to some dark places. Have either of you guys seen Jungle Cruise?
No, I haven't.
Since you know, we're all big Dwayne the Rock Johnson fans. Jungle Cruise is actually pretty fun. It's basically Emily Blunt and her brother's characters. They want to go into the Amazon to find this plant. And of course, Jesse Plemons is navigating the Amazon River in a submarine, which is actually pretty freaking awesome.
Also, is he like a German officer or something?
Yeah. He speaks with a German accent and he's in a German U-boat. So I guess he is.
So is he a Nazi man?
No.
So it's like World War One.
Yeah. He doesn't wear Nazi insignias or anything. I'm not sure. It's definitely takes place in the past. I don't know if it's the 30s or the 20s or whatever, but it kind of gets dark because the whole thing starts revolving around, like, people have been joking about ghost pirates, but they're actually ghost conquistadors. Ooh. Because, you know, the Amazon was, you know, basically overrun by the conquistadors. Anyway, it's a,
yeah,
won't go into it too much because it's not really horror, but it's a fun one. And it's got The Rock. The Rock, oh my God, he tells the worst dad jokes ever. And at one point, Emily Blunt kind of calls him on it. He goes, because they're going into headhunter territory, and he goes, we're headed downriver into headhunter territory, which is a bad place to be headed. And Emily Blunt goes, not now. And he goes, can't turn it off.
It is so funny. Dad jokes and Emily Blunt as a fun adventurer. I'm sold.
Yeah, you're in.
Speaking of The Rock, I know these two know this. And you guys can't see it, so I'll make sure to post a picture after this episode airs. But we have two fantastic additions to the Eye on Horror office. That's right. My boy Sky hooked us up with two action figures of Lizzie and Ralph from the movie Rampage to be displayed in the Eye on Horror main offices. It's in my living room right now.
Hey, we work from home. That is the main office.
Yeah. I did have to find one of George on eBay, so that will be coming in by the time this episode airs. So when I post the picture, it will be of all three. But yeah, long live Rampage forever.
Also, while we're digging into stuff that's not really horror, but we also, this goes along with, I know last year we were talking about the Fire Festival. Have you guys watched that Woodstock documentary on HBO Max?
I did. Woodstock 99.
Peace, Love, and Rage. Holy shit.
I already hate white men already, so dude, I don't need
you,
more.
No, basically, that's its whole thesis, is that Woodstock 99 was a straight, white, cis, male, frat boy haven. And they make the observation, they're like, there are three female acts on this. There's Sheryl Crow, Jewel, and I even forget who the other one is, but they had one on each day of the festival. So it's like they just went, okay, and here's the act for the ladies. And it's kind of ridiculous because then the bands that they had on there, like you can kind of see where it took a turn for the worst is Limp Bizkit on Saturday night. That's where it turned and really just started getting toxic. And Fred Durst, of course, is egging it on, even though promoters were begging him. They're like, oh, dude, calm the crowd down. He's like, oh, I'm going to break shit, you know. But and then Rage Against the Machine played after him, which they, you know, I don't think anything really happened during their set. But then Metallica went on and shit went crazy again. And then the next day, people were They were tired. The plumbing was broken, so the restrooms didn't work. They were charging $4 a bottle for water. So,
and this was in 99 when water wasn't $4 a bottle at festivals. Just context.
By the time the Chili Peppers went on, I think they might have been the headliner, but the place was completely on fire. And they talk about how they went to Anthony Kiedis. They said, "Hey, you have to calm the crowd down. You know, they're letting shit on fire." Well, the Chili Peppers come out and do their encore with Jimi Hendrix's Fire.
Yep.
You're like, dudes, no, that is not what we need from you. But it's crazy. I mean, just the look at that whole frat boy, white wrapped new metal scene, you know, because like Kid Rock was another one of the ones that people, and it's weird because, I mean, I'm no fan of Kid Rock, but you can see that he's a talented motherfucker, but just by the shots of him playing in this, he can, like, any instrument that he would walk up behind his keyboard player and sit down, or walk up with his DJ and start scratching. You know, any one of the instruments in his band, he would walk up and take it for the person to start ripping. You're like, dude. But the thing that is so weird about it, one of the promoters at one point said, because basically all the women were walking around with their tops off, and one of the promoters said, you know, because there were a lot of sexual assaults at this thing. And one of the promoters goes, "Well, you have to wonder, you know, how much sexual assault there'd be if these women weren't walking around naked the whole weekend." And you're like, it's like the biggest shouldn't have worn that dress moment. It's like just such a facepalm. You're like, oh, dude, how about
that's fucked up?
Yeah. How about you teach these toxic frat boys to, you know, not assault women just because they see their boobs? It's like, ugh. But anyway, it's an amazing. You know, it kind of goes hand in hand with that Fyre Festival doc. Although this one is more infuriating because a little bit of it is the promoter's fault, but a lot of it is just, I mean, it's the promoter's fault because the bands they booked. I mean, when you put that much testosterone on one stage, what did you expect to happen?
But it's also a logistics, you know, huge, like you said, the plumbing was bad. They didn't have enough resources, so they started jacking up the prices because it got limited. They didn't have enough security. They didn't do enough. They didn't do enough to keep people safe, as is one of the big issues. I used to have a Woodstock 99 shirt. I got it, found it at a thrift store, and I remember wearing it in high school a lot. I wish I still had it just because it was cool, a tie-dye shirt. And it's funny because it said Festival of Love, and I knew the history behind it. But no, I think Kathleen Hanna said it best. I think it was at one of the MTV Movie Awards or Music Awards. And it was her and her husband came out, and she gave like a full statement about how that was absolute bullshit, what happened at Woodstock 99. They have the footage in the documentary about her, the punk singer. And it's chilling, dude, just hearing her account of it and just like totally damning everyone that was involved in the organization of it. And That's why I wasn't so eager to jump into it, because I already knew the story, and it's just like, I don't want to, like...
I remember when it was on, MTV had, like, live coverage of it, and I remember Kurt Loder and Serena Alschult, they were, like, scared on live TV. They're saying, "We're getting the fuck out of here." They didn't say fuck, because they were still on, you know, they knew they were on TV, but they said, "We're getting out of here. This is dangerous." And this is during, you know, right after the Chili Pepper set, and people were looting food trucks and stuff, you know, setting stuff on fire, burning this place down. The other female artist was Alanis Morissette. I want to give her a little bit of credit. So the three female artists that represented Alanis Morissette, Sheryl Crow, and Jewel. And they held it on some old decommissioned military base. So it was all concrete with this big fence around it, because that was the big thing. They wanted to avoid the mistakes of the other two Woodstocks and keep gatecrashers out, which also kept the paying guests in, I guess. So anyway, it's horrifying.
Yeah. Well, I do have some horror to talk about, because it's been a minute. But the last time we met, we talked about Fear Street, but we mainly only talked about the first two. Well, guess what? It's been almost a month, and I finally did watch the third one.
1666.
Oh, man. That was... What a great third act, and what a great, like, encompassing of it. Especially when that mid-movie title... I try not to spoil anything, but the mid-movie title card, you know? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Part two.
It wraps it up. Yeah.
Oh, man. That was great. There was some like really great moments. I liked how they did a really good job of selling that it wasn't just the main character seeing the past. It was her living through her eyes, which is why they replaced, like, they had, like, actors from all over the timeline playing roles in 1666. And, oh, man, I just thought it came together so well. And then, like, the twist at the end was just so well executed. I fully agree. I agree with everyone that I would love to see this director continue to build the Fear Street world and to create, as they call it, the MCU of horror on Netflix. But I'm just more excited to see what more they can do, more original out of them. You know what I mean? Like, I would have loved to seen, you know, expanded universe on The Witch and stuff. But I'm glad that that director went on to go create other original stuff. So I really want to see what she does, because Fear Street as a full story trilogy was just absolutely fantastic. Can't recommend it enough.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to see more in the future. And as for me, just before I left for the East Coast, I actually did something really fun. I went to a Screamathon at the New Beverly, so I got to watch Screams 1 through 4 back to back to back in 35mm, and it was a blast.
When you said Screamathon, I was like, oh, so what titles are in it? And you're like, Scream 1 through 4. And it's like, oh, I'm just so used to what it's like. It's a ghoulish marathon. Ooh, what ghoul? I don't expect them to play Ghoulies 1 through 4 at a ghoulish marathon. But I guess, yeah, a Screamathon, you know, that makes sense. How was it revisiting those in theaters with an audience?
Oh, man, it was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was... Well, the thing is, I've seen only Screams 1, 2, and 4, so that was my first time seeing Scream 3, which, you know, is kind of the derided entry in the series. But, you know, honestly, it was pretty good. Wasn't as bad as people made it out to be.
I like Scream 3. Scream 3 is very meta, because basically, yeah. Now, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but Scream 3, aren't they on the set of Stab 2?
Stab 7.
Yeah. That's right. They went farther than that. But yeah, they're making one of the sequels to the movie about the first one, Stab. Yeah. Oh, Stab 7. Oh.
And they got Parker Posey as Courtney Cox's character. And so they do kind of like a weird Scooby-Doo team up. And it was funny as hell.
Isn't Carrie Fisher in that one, too?
She has a cameo.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of great cameos in that one, too, because you got Roger Corman and Lance Henriksen and
Jane Silent Bob,
which I like to think means that this movie is set at the exact same time of Jane Silent Bob Strike Back. Like, both those movies are happening concurrently.
Yeah, because Miramax and them were really pushing to have Jane Silent Bob be the new Abbott and Costello, and we're trying to develop Jane Silent Bob meet Hellraiser.
Yeah, but anyway, seeing all four Screams back to back was a lot of fun, and just it put them in an interesting context, because they are really sequential, and damn it, they all hold up. You know, all of them are good movies. You know, simple fact. You know, Scream 1 and 2 are classics. Scream 3 was better than I expected. Scream 4, I have a much bigger appreciation for now. So it was pretty cool to watch them like that, and especially in a theater. So I'm actually pretty stoked to see what happens with Scream 5. Because it's happening, although it's just going to be known as Scream, because, you know, it's how a lot of these later movie sequels do.
Halloween.
Yeah. Although, yeah, Kevin Williamson, though, is back to write it. So I'm pretty excited to see how that comes about.
And it's from the duo that gave us the brilliant Ready or Not. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Radio Silence. Can't go wrong there.
Another thing that we haven't talked about, because we haven't met in so long, but it's kind of old news right now. Get it? Dad jokes. Shyamalan's Old. You guys both seen it, right?
Sorry, I'm still reeling in from that terrible joke segue. It's like, I know we're the kings of segues, but... Oh.
Yeah, Old. Okay, full disclosure, I'm a Shyamalan fanboy. I even like The Happening.
I love The Happening.
Yeah, me too.
Take that with a grain of salt, but I thought Old was really good. I really enjoyed it. There are parts of it that are kind of silly. This was a problem with The Happening as well. I kind of wish Shyamalan would have someone help him write his dialogue, because I think he has great story ideas, but some of his dialogue is a little
some of it.
Well, in this one, a lot of it. But like, if you're looking at movies like Sixth Sense or Split, which, you know, spoiler alert, we're going to be later. But anyway, not all of his movies are like that. And with The Happening, I think we kind of, you know, spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about this later, but The Happening, I feel like they're trying to take it to like a 50s sci-fi level. So it's kind of forgiven. I'm not sure. The only thing I can think of with old is these kids, as they're growing up on this beach, you know, if anyone doesn't know the concept, these people go to this beach and they start aging. It's like 2 years every hour, I think is what it is. So you'll basically live your entire life in like a day and a half. But the kids in it, when, as they grow old, they are children in these adult bodies. So I kind of get them saying stupid stuff, but like the one that would kill me, and this got funny after a while, is one of the characters is a therapist. And every time something dramatic happens, she goes, "We should talk about what just happened."
Okay. First of all, I love The Happening because it plays out exactly dialogue and everything like a 50s, like a cheesy B movie 50s sci-fi film. Like it would be right. It is prime for MST3K, and it was brilliant because it had all these big stars and a big budget. And when you approach it with that mindset, it's a fun movie. And I was so excited for the first like 15 minutes of old. I was like, do we have a successor to The Happening? And then it just kept getting, it just did not have that balance. It had, I counted, 5 fucking endings. Like that movie could have ended at least 5 times, and it kept going. It was like, here's the twist, but no, we're going to keep going with it. Oh, we're not dead yet. We're going to keep going. Oh, but it's so annoying. Have some mystery to it, man. You don't need to keep, like, especially with old, like, they could have stopped it, like, so much earlier, and it would have been like, whoa, that was cool. I wonder what else. It's like, no, we're going to keep showing you. But it was nothing cool. It was nothing well. And the dialogue, fuck you on saying that it was sometimes bad. It was so, there is literally a part in the beginning. Okay, so the parents of the kids are fighting. They're going through marital stuff, and they're not even really fighting. They're just kind of having a discussion, and all of a sudden, the wife just goes, "Your head is stuck in the future." And he goes, "Yeah, well, you're stuck in the past. You work in a museum." I turned to my buddy and just went, "Oh, if only they learned to live in the present, maybe they could save their marriage."
It was foreshadowing that car ride where I think the girl is singing and she's like, "I can't wait to hear your voice in the future." It's like all this heavy handed foreshadowing that,
but
you know,
it's so heavy handed. And like, it's just like,
wait until you get older. That was another thing they said. They want to do something. They're like, "Oh, wait until you get older." He's like, "Oh, so in about 4 hours."
No, and the thing is that, like, and there are times in Knight's films where, like, he is not that great with dialogue and really should work with a co-writer. But usually it's made up with, like, some very interesting camera work. He's very good with an eye for cinema. But there were some, like, really great and very interesting angles that he used in this film, and then other times there was just some like really weird choices that did not work. Like there was a lot of times when the kids first start aging where they're not showing them, but you can hear like the voices change, and you can see like it's clearly like the arm of an older child or something like that, but they're not showing the faces yet to be revealed. Like there was some really cool and interesting stuff they were doing with there, and then there were times where like you were saying, like, "Oh, I can't wait to hear your voice older." And then later on when the kid's like older and they sing and it stays on the mom's face. And like, I get that maybe you were trying to go for like, you know, showing the emotional range of the mom acting and reacting, but they weren't doing anything. And it just got really like uninteresting very quickly. I will say this, that the two actors who were the kids at like teenage, early 20s age, so the guy from Hereditary
and the girl from Jojo Rabbit,
they were phenomenal. They I think they really nailed the young kid in an older person's body, and that balance of their minds kind of developing but not really developing, because they did explore that a little bit in the movie too, where it's like, oh, all these new feelings and stuff because they're hitting puberty so quick, but their mind's not really catching up, but there's still that.
There's one point it was I literally started laughing because there's something that happens. I don't want to spoil it. Old is the only Shyamalan movie we're not going to spoil today because it's so new. But there's one thing that happens while they're growing old that I couldn't believe they went there, but they had to go there because it would totally happen in real life. And I know that you know what I'm talking about.
I don't know, because I'm just thinking of all the things that made me angry in that movie. See, this is the thing, is that the movie had some, like, cool ideas, but then there was a lot of, like, really dumb ones that came. There was a lot of dumb deaths. There was a lot of dumb dialogue. There was a lot of weird camera angles that didn't work. What was the name of the hip-hop artist in the movie? Like,
Full-Size Sedan.
Yeah, Full-Size Sedan, which, great hip-hop artist name. Love it. Terrible name for a character in your fucking movie. I'm gonna say it. Like, I ultimately left the theater a bit disappointed. Like, it was, I'm glad I saw it with my buddy, and I'm glad we saw it in a theater where there wasn't a lot of people, so I could lean over and crack jokes every now and then. But, yeah, dude, it didn't have that, a good balance. And again, I don't mind stuff having multiple elongated endings. I applaud The Good Place for continuing on for another episode and, like, giving an epitaph to all its characters. But Jesus fucking Christ, that had, like, 5 endings to it. And I was just so exhausted and so tired and so full of oversalted popcorn. That was my bad, not the theater's bad. But, yeah, I just, it didn't vibe with me.
Let's move on to what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about Shyamalan twists. And not every one of his movies has a twist, so we're not going to talk about all of them, I'm sure.
Spoiler alert, not all of his movies have twists.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert,
we're going to spoil every Shyamalan movie except Old. We're going to be respectful in case you haven't seen Old yet. But the rest of them, we're going to spoil the hell out of them. So if you haven't seen Shyamalan movies, let's go chronologically through them.
From the beginning.
Well, not the beginning, because his first two movies, Praying with Anger and Wide Awake, no twists.
Sure.
But the one that put him on the map, The Sixth Sense.
The classic.
Classic twist. This coined the phrase Shyamalanian twist.
Yeah, now that one was really big for its time, especially because, you know, it's like, especially for a horror movie, you know, it was amazing that it became such a huge impact on popular culture.
It's horror in quotes, kind of like Silence of the Lambs. It's like,
sure.
You know, it's Oscar horror, actually, you could call it. Oscar,
yeah, that's definitely one way of putting it.
I believe they call that thriller. Oscar horror. It's called thriller.
Jerome.
But there are a whole lot of ghosts because, you know, anyone who's been living under a rock for the last 30 years or 22 years or whatever, Sixth Sense is about the boy who sees dead people. And here's where we spoil it. The twist is Bruce Willis, the psychiatrist who's helping him, is dead the whole time.
And what a waste of an afterlife. This dude's dead. He could be in heaven. He could be in hell. He could be scaring people. He could be pranking people. He could be doing so many spooky, cool ghost shit. But what does he do? He goes to fucking work.
Yeah, he doesn't even realize he's dead.
That's the thing. He needed help moving on. And that's where the little boy came in. So I think The Sixth Sense is the classic. It is probably It is the standard of Shyamalanian twists that we are going to measure Shyamalanian twists by.
It's also one of the few times that M. Night actually did a good job with a child actor, because especially if old proved anything, that I love Shyamalan. He's such a nice guy. I met him once and he was nothing but like the nicest guy ever. But like, man, dude, his work with child actors is just like not there, especially in Old, dude. Those early scenes were very rough.
Part of that is probably he had Haley Joel Osment, though.
That kid was a prodigy. Like,
yeah, I think part of it is the actor himself. I mean, granted, with child actors, you put more of the emphasis on the director because he's kind of directing them. But I think that if you have a talented canvas, it makes it easier. So I think a lot of that is that. Let's move on to Unbreakable.
Fuck yeah, dude.
More Bruce Willis. And this time Bruce Willis survives a train wreck that kills everybody else on it, and he doesn't have a scratch on him. And he figures out he's a superhero. That's not the twist.
What's the twist?
The twist is Samuel L. Jackson, who is the world's most breakable man, Mr. Glass, is he basically thinks of himself as a supervillain, and he has been staging all these accidents around the world to find his arch nemesis. And that's what he did. When he staged this train crash, and when Bruce Willis survived without a scratch on him, he said, "There, that's my nemesis." So that's the twist.
Yeah, no, I just love that flash. Or like when he finds out the truth, and Samuel Jackson just says, "They called me Mr. Glass." was just such a stunning, you know, kind of end line.
I mean, that was ahead of its time. I know. I think Unbreakable didn't do super tremendous at the box office, but like it was ahead of its time in doing comic books and being critiquing it, and just a great performance from Bruce Willey. You know, that was before
and Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, especially Samuel L. Jackson in that one. Yeah. I mean, who doesn't remember the scene when he falls into the pool? I mean, that was just...
And now Unbreakable is... You're still pretty good on the twist scale with Shyamalan. This one is still pretty good. I mean, you can see it coming a little further away, but it's still pretty solid.
Yeah. The movie's not dependent on it yet. You know what I mean? Like, it's there. You kind of know it's coming, but it's not going to make... the twist didn't make or break Unbreakable. Like, even without the twist, like, it's a solid film. Same with Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense kind of, you know, that's what really made it good. But it's not like you need it yet.
A couple years later, Signs.
Hmm.
I haven't really seen Signs since it came out, but it...
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time either, but... Signs is basically an alien invasion movie. Mel Gibson with his crisis of faith. And the twist in this one is the aliens can be defeated by water, which you're like, okay, why the hell did they pick a planet that's 70% water to invade? It's like, come on, do your homework, aliens. This is pretty typical of like War of the Worlds. We're talking about how The Happening is like 50s sci-fi tribute. This kind of is like that too, because at the end of War of the Worlds, you know, the aliens are defeated by bacteria or, you know, germs.
But the thing is that like, and you could definitely see that like Shyamalan was going for like a more intimate story instead of like a global, everyone's dealing with these aliens everywhere, like in War of the Worlds. And then the big twist is they weren't used to the bacteria. That makes sense because, you know, you can have, you can make the argument that the aliens didn't have sensors. They didn't think about that, and that is something that happens a lot, even just going from one continent to another, you know, not, you know, that's why people have terrible bowel movements when they go travel, you know, stuff like that. But like, yeah, you can see water from space, especially Earth's water. We have a lot, we're mostly water.
But maybe these aliens, I just thought of this, maybe these aliens didn't know that their weakness is water. Maybe if their planet has no water, maybe it's a completely foreign concept to them. I don't know. Anyway, Signs, you're slipping a little bit, Knight. You're this one. But 2 years after that, The Village.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
As far as Shyamalanian twists go, The Village is pretty fucking rad. The whole movie, you think it's a period piece. But then at the very end, you discover that these people are living in this like national park in the past. And it actually takes place in modern time. That's your twist. And Shyamalan is back. This is another one of those jaw droppers. You know, all of the goodwill he lost in Signs is back with The Village.
Yeah. Funny enough, at the time, there was a lot of criticism about the twist. But I think it's one of those rare cases where the twist actually aged better than when it initially came out. Because, yeah, I mean, a lot of people complained at the time. But, you know, in retrospect, it actually was a pretty good twist that's sticking with the themes of, control. Because, you know, it's this Puritan style society of people who think modern times is sinful. So they made it, you know, like a historical time and lied about it to the children, the people raised in the town. So yeah, it's definitely better than it was initially given credit for when it came out.
And that was, I think, one of the first times Shyamalan went too far into explaining the twist or going into it. For The Village, it kind of works because that brings up a lot of questions like, wait, why haven't they seen plants? Why has no one discovered them yet? And like, so they do spend the time to be like, oh, it's because they worked out a deal with the local government to not have planes fly over that area, or they worked out a deal and they bought the land and fenced it off and have a security person there who's played by Shyamalan and all this, you know, kooky stuff like that. And like that I get, you know, because it's like, okay, yeah, I guess you can take the time to explain it. But I don't know. For me, I feel like with twists, you kind of got to get in and get out a little bit. But I mean, it worked for The Village. I thought that was a very above average film.
That brings us to The Happening.
Yes. Oh, can I explain this one?
Yes, go for it. Go for it.
So The Happening is Shyamalan's masterpiece, his magnum opus, if I do say so myself. No, people are mysteriously murdering themselves all across the land, and no one knows why. But then they start to realize, oh, it's the plants doing it. Why? Climate change, and Mother Nature's fighting back, buddy. Oh my God, it's fucking great. From the iconic scenes of them going, the wind is blowing this way, and running in the other direction. No, no, it's blowing the other way. And I could watch that bit on repeat for hours and be entertained. Plus, it had some gnarly kills. Like the dude throwing himself into the lion pit. There was one guy who threw his head, dove headfirst into a lawnmower. Like, ah. Oh, and who could forget Marky Mark going, come on. Be scientific, douchebag.
Right, that's the thing. It's Marky Mark, which is weird because...
That's the hardest sell of the movie.
You guys know that I'm the biggest Boogie Nights fan you're ever going to watch. I think he is perfectly cast. And that's what I think... That's why I think he's so good as, well, Dirk Diggler.
His second best role.
Eddie from Torrance. But his second best role. Is his first The Happening?
What? No. No, the reason why he works so well in The Happening is because he's so miscast. Like, who would believe that a guy with that Mark Wahlberg, with super thick Boston accent and everything, would make for a good science teacher? Like, get the fuck out of here.
What do you think his best role is?
His best role is Fear. Come on.
He's not acting in Fear.
I know. He's not That's acting. Why it's his best role. That's why it's his best. You're not going to... Come on. Andrew Dice Clay is best when he's playing Andrew Dice Clay, you know? Burt Reynolds is best when he's Burt Reynolds, you know, like in Raven, all right? And Marky Mark is great. Come on, that scene when William Peterson walks away and he starts pounding his chest. And you're like, what is this guy doing? And then, like, he shows up and he's like, oh, yeah, it's fucking great. Fear is fantastic. I'm not saying that it's Marky Mark's best movie. I'm just saying, like, fit in the role, that was his best.
Let's skip over to The Visit. I did not see this twist coming at all. Basically, The Visit is it's his found footage movie. The little girl's a budding filmmaker, and her brother are going to go visit the grandparents. So they go, they visit the grandparents, and something's weird about the grandparents. They can't put their finger on it, but they're weird. And they've never met these grandparents, which is kind of foreshadowing for the twist, because the twist at one point they're Skyping with mom, and then mom sees the grandparents and goes, kids, don't panic. Those are not your grandparents. Dun, dun, dun. And they were in that they were spending their summer mom went on a cruise. So they were spending their mom's cruise with people who were not their grandparents.
They really jumped through hoops to establish why the kids wouldn't know what the grandparents look like, why there was no one going, hey, those aren't them. But basically, like, the whole time the grandparents have been acting weird, and it turns out that this old couple are just like crazy as fuck and are
mental patients. Yeah.
Yeah. And they murdered the actual grandparents and were posing as them just because, you know, crazy be crazy like that. It's not the, like, you know, best at displaying mental health, you know, but
I thought you were gonna say it's not his best twist. I'm all, it's fucking up there though, but no, you're right, it is not the best at portraying mental health at all.
But also after like three films of four films with like this, Split, Glass, and then now Old, like, I think we've established that he's not there is some really good stuff, like talking about sundown syndrome and stuff, which I thought was really great, and like how they get they get put into overdrive with their weirdness after the sun goes down, because that is fact, or not fact, but that is something that happens a lot with some cases, you know, like dementia and whatnot. But my biggest issues with The Visit is purely just the same issues that always come up with found footage stuff, which is like, why was the camera still rolling there?
Because she's a budding filmmaker. That's why I thought that was one of the most organic parts of the movie. This little girl is like a budding Spielberg. So she films her entire life. I thought that was one of the more organic parts of the movie. It's one of the more organic found footage movies, I think.
I mean, like, as a generic explanation as to why, okay, I'll give you that, but like, angles, why it's still going, you know, there's just like a lot of just inherent issues I have with found footage, and that
she's
that
a budding Spielberg, she's gonna have the creative angles.
But no, I mean, just like it's stuff like, I'm running, but I'm still gonna make sure I'm pointing the camera at the thing that's chasing me, even though, you know, I mean, like, it works for films like Willow Creek we're not getting into issues
you
about the movie,
always just, get the shot. God, you've worked on enough movies where you know you always get the shot.
This is why found footage annoys me so much. No, I thought it was really solid. Plus, it's got my girl Catherine Hahn in it. So, you know, got to give respect to her. She sells the twist. Catherine Hahn, everyone loves her now because of WandaVision. I've been in love with her for years. And she is honestly the thing, the reason I kept watching that movie. And she sold that twist.
She delivers
face,
it. She's like, kids, those aren't your grandparents. And the thing is, and as far as Shyamalan twists go, this one shows up pretty early. I mean, it's probably the two-thirds point that you figure this out. So you still have the third act with these kids knowing these aren't their grandparents. It's not like, you know, those aren't your grandparents, fade to black. I mean, you have a good third of the movie.
And then this is where we start to see him go too far with explaining stuff, where they go into these people's mental health history and they're like, and then it turns into like the kid, like it's like they're trying to say like, oh yeah, this kid's trying to finish up their A&E true crime story and diving into the history of this old mental couple that broke into it. And it's just like, dude, just let it end with them escaping and then just end it.
You know, I kind of agree with you there. At that point, she should probably turn the camera off and get the fuck out. Yeah, you're right.
It's just like there's over-explaining. It's like that's why the theatrical cut of Donnie Darko is better than the director's cut. You don't have to explain everything.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty effective twist. And, you know, just because it was simple, you know, it's like it's a classic horror twist. You know, it's like the person you thought you knew was not, in fact, who you thought. And it just did such a great job marketing wise, too, because, you know, there was that creepy trailer where it's just the footage of the old grandma, like putting herself in the oven.
Well, she's trying to convince the little girl to get into the oven. And you think you're like, oh, shit.
Get into the oven.
Yeah. All the way in the back. Way back there.
Yeah. No, but yeah. So, you know, sometimes the simplest twist is the best one.
Yeah. Oh, and the thing is, everybody is like, oh, that twist was so obvious. Well, not to me. I was sitting in the theater watching this and that one hit me like a freight train. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing.
It was very Hansel and Gretel. Yeah, overall.
Well, that scene was. Let's cruise on to Split. Which Split?
What was the twist?
Yeah, that's the thing.
Oh, yeah, it was a twist.
The twist is in the mid-credits scene.
But was there a twist before that, though? I thought there was a twist with McAvoy. So the twist of Split is that there was no twist until the mid-credits scene.
Yeah.
Right?
That was the twist. Split is basically James McAvoy in an amazing performance as this guy with multiple personality. I think he's got 23. And he kidnaps these three girls, keeps them there, and he goes through all these different personalities. And basically, it's these girls trying to escape from him. And at the very end, mid-credit scene, there's a news report about it. And they start talking about how, you know, he's the Beast, like some kind of a supervillain. And then they're at a diner and they go, who is that guy? What did he call himself? And then she moves out of the way, the girl who's saying this, and it's Bruce Willis. And he says, Mr. Glass, this is a secret Unbreakable sequel. Yes.
Or a spinoff.
Well, it was a sequel. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, sequel, spinoff, same universe. It was amazing.
I mean, it's definitely the Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift of the, you know, what is it? The US 117 trilogy? I don't know. But basically, like, yeah, it took place in the universe, but there's only really like one cameo bit. Only instead of one bald white guy, Vin Diesel, it's another bald white guy in Bruce Willis, you know?
Well, that is the twist. The twist is that it is a secret Unbreakable sequel, which I thought that one was really well done because the credits are rolling and you're like, oh, wow, okay. No Shyamalan twist in this one, you know, which isn't unheard of as we've been talking about. So you're like, okay, you know, probably his best non-twist movie. And then it hits you with it and you're like, ah, I spoke too soon.
Yeah, I think that was his most effective one because this was a prime example of a film where it wasn't hinged on its twist. You know what I mean? It was even like a mid-credit thing. Like if they cut it out, it still would have worked solid as a film, you know?
It's not hinged. It's almost like an afterthought.
Yeah. Again, not the best example of mental health in a movie as discussed.
Although it's you have to admit it's an amazing performance.
It's a good performance.
It's written a little questionably, but it's performed brilliantly.
But I think that's what makes it work so well is that it is a bit cartoony with it. So it is a little forgivable on not portraying mental health in the most accurate light, because it is very comic booky. It's very cartoony. So it does work a bit.
Which kind of, in retrospect, kind of foreshadows the twist, because it was kind of him doing his expanded comic book universe.
Right.
Which expands to Glass.
I haven't seen that one either.
You have not seen Glass? Oh, okay. Glass. Well, okay. Glass is what ties it all together. Basically, Mr. Glass, Samuel L. Jackson's character, wants to get the Beast, which is James McAvoy. And does Bruce Willis's character have a superhero name? His name's David Dunn. But anyway, he's trying to get them to fight. And they're all in the same institution. And Sarah Paulson is their doctor. And the twist is, it's kind of a confusing twist, but the twist is Sarah Paulson is part of some organization that likes to flesh out superheroes and then deny their existence, basically tries to keep them locked up in asylums so the world doesn't realize that they're superheroes. And at the end, David Dunn's son, Mr. Glass's mom, and one of the girls from Split has this weird Stockholm syndrome relationship with James McAvoy's character. They actually have all this footage, and they basically expose to the world that superheroes exist. So foils Sarah Paulson's plan. Not that great of a twist. It's a little reminiscent, not to spoil anything, it's a little reminiscent of Olds, and that's all I'm going to say about Old, because I don't want to ruin anything.
Oh, where it has 8 endings? It just continues endings?
It kind of, there are a couple places where it could end. Not quite 8, but yeah, there's a couple places.
Gives you a solid round number of 12 endings.
It does end with a pretty awesome fight between Bruce Willis and James McAvoy, with McAvoy as the Beast.
Which, give me a shirtless James McAvoy all you know, worked out and just beating on Bruce Willis like that. That sounds like a good time.
One of the most effective shots in Glass is, and I don't know why they did. Maybe they did this to trigger him. But Bruce Willis and James McAvoy are in cells in this mental institution, and they're like across the hall from each other. And at one point, both their doors open at the same time, and James McAvoy glances and sees Bruce Willis, and it's like, "Oh, wait, it's that dude." I mean, it's pretty amazingly done. The reveal on how they find out that they're both in the same place is pretty, it's pretty crazy. Anyway, that brings us to Old, which we've already talked about and we don't want to spoil. So we're not going to talk Shyamalanian twists with Old. What about movies with Shyamalanian twists that aren't Shyamalan? Like, we've talked ad nauseum about Antebellum, I don't know if I want to spoil it, but it steals its twist from one of the movies that we've discussed already.
The first thing that comes to mind in terms of Shyamalan-esque twist would be In the Mouth of Madness, John Carpenter's movie. Like, are we talking spoilers or?
Yeah, sure, spoil it.
Yeah, well, you know, just the twist in that is that it turns out Sam Neill's character was a character all along. Like, he was within the story the whole time, and he's nothing more than a character in Sutter Kane's books. And, you know, eventually, you know, that the story overtakes reality. So, yeah, I mean, particularly for its time, I think it was rather shocking.
Have you guys seen Identity?
Oh, yeah, that's a great example.
That's another one where, it changes the entire movie if you know the twist, so I'm not going to say what it is. But Identity is one of those that, like, when you get to the twist, everything that you've seen up to that point changes. So, anyway, but it's, you know, John Cusack and Rebecca De Mornay, I think, is one. It's like Ray Liotta. Talk about an all-star cast. You know, they're all stranded at this hotel in the rain, and they can't go anywhere.
And then they start to piece together, why are they all here? Because there's something that brought them all to this hotel on this
night. They all have the same birthday, and they're like, oh, this is just too weird. Yeah.
But I think, because there was definitely a slew of movies that came out where it was, you know, studios trying to cash in on the Shyamalan twist and doing stuff. And I think Identity was probably the most successful of those knockoffs, you know, not only just like at the box office, but just like in pulling off its thing. I thought, it's not a great movie, but it's very solid. You know, that was one that, like, for some reason played in my house a lot when I was a kid. So I just have a lot of fun memories with that one.
And of course, there's The Usual Suspects, which is another one of those movies that when you get to the twist, it changes everything that happened before it.
What about Nicole Kidman and the others?
That works.
That's another, but see, that steals its twist from a Shyamalan movie that we've talked about as well. So,
but it's a fun ghost story, like more of a ghost story. And like, yeah, I just got the re-release of that on Blu-ray. I need to revisit that one because I just remember loving that one a lot when I was growing up. Like that was one of the my gateway horror films as a kid, you know?
All right, let's get out of here. What are your favorite Shyamalanian? You know what I really want to hear from? What are your favorite Shyamalanian twists that aren't Shyamalan? You know, because I know that we kind of just glossed over it because we are running a little long. So, hit us up and let us know. And also let us know what your favorite, are we crazy that we think that Signs is kind of a dumb twist? Let us know.
Do you agree with us that The Happening is his magnum opus and the best thing that he's ever made?
I don't know if I would say that. I do think it's underappreciated. I don't know magnum. It's not his worst movie. I mean, it's not even close to his. In fact, I would say Last Airbender and After Earth are both worse because they don't have twists. People expect that. What?
Oh, that's what's wrong with them. Yeah, not the whitewashing of Avatar, and you know.
All right, let's get out of here. So, let us know what your thoughts on this are. You can let us know at the Ion Horror Facebook, the iHorror Facebook, Ion Horror Twitter, the Ion Horror Instagram, iHorror.com. Geez, anywhere else? I don't know. We're not hard to find. Our theme song is by Restless Spirit, so go and rock with them. They're making a new record. They've been recording. And our artwork is Chris Fisher. Give him some love, too. And that's it for us. So we'll see you hopefully in a couple weeks, depending on how our schedules go. So we'll see you soon. So for me, James Shea Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
Keep your eye on horror.